so it must officially be the time to start our goodwill and impairment session. It's the last of the plenary sessions today, and I'll be back to give you the admin on the breakout sessions that will follow. But first, for our session on goodwill and impairment, I'd like to introduce the two panel members. First, far side, let me introduce Jingzhao Liu, who I think is a familiar face to many of you because he's a good example of the ISB's commitment to recycling. Having started as a staff member a number of years ago, he was back in China with the Ministry of Finance and served as director of the Accounting Regulatory Department, and in these roles also represented China on ASAF before he joined the board. And so we are delighted to have him here leading the session on goodwill and impairment. And he is very ably supported by Dihao Feng. And this is despite the fact that Dihao is not only involved in goodwill and impairment, but also in primary financial statements. So clearly, we are keeping him very, very busy in his at the ISB. So let me turn over to both of them for their overview of goodwill and impairment. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mary. Good afternoon, everyone. So now we are going to move on, as Hans said, that most exciting and difficult topic, impairment and goodwill and impairment. I think it's a fair comment, as Hans mentioned this morning. This topic, everyone can talk about that, but when we ask them to, or even among the board members, we needed to develop some kind of better solution. It seems that it's not easy. Why it is not easy? I think it is not simply because the accounting treatment of goodwill is not is you know is difficult, it's complicated. Mainly because of the assets we are accounting for is so special and unique, the goodwill. If we look at some companies, they got a large number of the goodwill on the balance sheet. But we cannot touch it, we cannot see it, we cannot smell it, we cannot sell it individually. There is no, you know, separate market available for those goodwills. But those goodwills are recognized on the balance sheet as an asset. So this is the difficult accounting reality we are facing, because the assets is such a difference from other assets. But this kind of accounting treatment for goodwill is also very important, particularly for investors and creditors. This morning, when I go through the slides and when I listening to the presentation of PFS, I think how can we meet the information needs of users is so important. And it reminded me a case that is earlier last year, one of the biggest construction company in UK collapsed. The company is Carillion. And when I read that news last year, the first reaction I had is just search on the website to look at the annual report of that company. What assets the company had. When I opened the website and read the annual report, very interesting, soon before the company collapsed, the total assets of that company is 4.4 billion. But if you look at the detail of those assets the company has, the largest, the biggest assets the company has is goodwill. The amount of the goodwill is 1.6 billion. So that means the goodwill accounts for over 35% of total assets. But once the company collapsed, that means that assets mean nothing. There is no any value available for investors as well as for creditors. So that means, you know, this project is also very important because how can we deliver useful information to users with regard to the goodwill and impairment? I think this is exactly the title we're giving, that's better information about the business combination, not only limited to impairment of goodwill. So where we are now about this project, and where this project come from. So now Tehao and I are going to update you the latest development of this project. We all know that the board issued the IFI 3 business combination in 2004, and then revised these standards in 2008. After the standards was implemented for several years, the board started so-called PIR, that is post-implementation review of IFI 3. And the board started that review, I think, in 2013. And in 2015, the board completed the PIR and issued a statement, summarized all the feedbacks we received. One of the biggest concerns we received from stakeholders is about subsequent accounting for goodwill, especially impairment. There's a lot of criticism, there are a lot of concerns, different views on how to improve the impairment accounting for goodwill. So based on those feedback, the board decided to initiate this project as a research project at this moment. And afterwards, we did a lot of research, outreach, and consultation activities, try to find a solution. By now, I think board already completed all of deliberation on this project. And in July board meeting, the board also decided what type of the consultation paper we should have for next step of the project. We decided that should be the discussion paper rather than exposure draft. So based on the board's decision, I will talk about what's the decision and what's the topic we'll cover by the discussion paper. Today we are going to talk about three main issues. One is that what's the problems the board identified and heard during the PIR. Secondly, Tehao and I are going to cover five main topics discussed by the board and provide some views, preliminary views on those topics. First, whether we need or how can we improve the disclosure with regard to the business combination. Secondly, whether we need to reintroduce amortization of goodwill or whether we still need to retain existing impairment test model. Third, because currently the standard require entity to do annual quantitative impairment test for goodwill, whether we need to provide relief on this requirement. Fourthly, the fourth topic is value in use, whether there are any room the board can do to simplify the calculation of VIU, value in use. And the fifth topic we are going to touch on is intangible assets, whether we need to reconsider the existing requirement of separately identifying and recognizing and measuring of those intangible assets, acquired through the business combination. For those five topics, we are going to talk about that. Finally, I will talk about what's the next step of this project. Of course, after our presentation, we got seven Slido questions we are going to ask you. And then, if time permitted, please type any questions on the Slido, and we are going to answer those questions. So now, first topic, what kind of problems we heard during the PIR? I think there are several problems we identified, and I think we needed to tackle those issues. First, many investors told us that existing disclosure on business combination is not sufficient. As I said, previous Corellium cases, exactly, because I look at the annual report soon before they issued, soon before they collapsed, they using several paragraphs to try to convince the investor, said they did a very good impairment test, and the results show that, okay, the recoverable amount is always over the carrying amount. I think that information may be not enough for the users. So therefore, particularly investors told us that some they want more information, particularly on the information on subsequent performance of acquired business. So this is the first problem we identified. Secondly, many stakeholders told us that existing impairment test loss, impairment losses recognition always, you know, too late. Yeah. Because based on the existing, you know, impairments test model, it seems that entities always would like to recognize those impairments lost a little bit later, not on timely basis. So once those information disclosed, it's already too late. The information value is very limited. It's only have, you know, confirmatory value rather than a predictive value. So the third problem we identify is that people said that the current impairment test also very costly and very complex to perform. Fourth question is about amortization. Some people say, okay, why don't you just reintroduce amortization? And this is maybe the simplest way to address the goodwill issues, to reduce the amount of the goodwill and also reduce the burden on the impairment test. And the fifth problem we identify is about the challenging of, as I said, identifying and measuring some intangible assets, such as business, you know, customer relationships, such as brands acquired through the business combination. Because currently we require entity to separately identify and recognizing and measure those assets at fair value. Some people say measure those assets, intangible assets at fair value is very difficult, particularly when those assets have no active market available. So how can board decide what kind of proposal we are going to do to resolve those problems? First, the board decided that we should specify the objective of the project first. Board decided that, okay, the objective of this project should explore whether there is any possibility, and also without additional or significant cost to the entities, then help users and provide users more useful information about the business combination, enabling users to hold management to account for their acquired business and also their acquisition decisions. So now I would like to hand over to Dehao, because we are going to talk about the details of those five topics, and Dehao will talk about the first three topics and what's the preliminary views the board has decided.
Okay, thanks, Jen Chao. And I will just talk about each of the board's preliminary views in a bit more detail here. So we have structured the presentation today as five separate topics, but we will very much hope that stakeholders could take the board view as a package of proposals rather than isolated topics. And that is because the board is trying to achieve a cost-benefit balance across all these different topics. So with that, the first topic that I would like to touch on today here is on how to provide users with better information about BizCom. And that is one of the key proposals in this project in response to what we have heard. And as many of you might be aware, this project came about as part of the post-implementation review for IFRS 3. And one of the recurring themes that we have heard so far from users is that existing disclosures do not provide sufficient information about BizCom. Particularly, users would like to know the driver underlying acquisition price, as well as how has the acquisition performed subsequently. On the other hand, preparers generally think that the existing requirements in the standard is already excessive. So IFRS 3 currently does not really contain any disclosure objectives on the acquisition price as well as on subsequent performance. So the board is therefore trying to develop proposals to improve the disclosure objectives of IFRS 3 by clarifying, firstly, why an acquirer has decided to purchase an acquiree. Secondly, why an acquirer is willing to pay the amount that it has agreed to. And last but not least, how has the acquisition performed subsequently? The board is also proposing to have some additional disclosure requirements in the subsequent years, as well as having some targeted improvements to some of the existing requirements in IFRS 3, which I will touch on in more details later. So there is an existing requirement in the standard for an entity to disclose the primary reasons for a business combination. But what users have told us is that that piece of information tend to be boilerplate. And therefore, the board is thinking of amending that requirement to require the company to first disclose in the year of acquisition the strategic rationale for entering into the BizCom. And that could be a high-level statement which can link back to the overall group strategy, which the company might have already well included in its management commentary. Second is to disclose the key objectives of the specific business combination that we are looking at. And this can be the target that management expect to achieve as a result of this acquisition. And third is to disclose the matrix that management will use to assess the extent to which those objectives have been achieved. Then, following from that, in the subsequent periods, the company will disclose the actual performance based on those matrices that it has identified. And that will enable users to assess whether this acquisition has been successful. And because most of the acquisitions generally involve large sums of money, we would presume that companies would have some kind of internal monitoring system to monitor how successful an acquisition has been. But if for some reason the business combination is not monitored by the management, or if the matrix that the management used to monitor has changed during the financial period, then we believe that that fact itself should be disclosed. So what are the information that needs to be disclosed in the subsequent years exactly? And to answer that question, we first try to ask users why they would need this piece of information in the first place. And most of them told us that it's mainly for stewardship purposes in order to assess whether management of the company can be entrusted with additional capital. But of course, there are also users who told us that it's mainly for valuation purposes. And in relation to the kind of matrix that should be disclosed, because given the wide range of business combination and the variety of purposes that they do serve, the board concluded that there is no single matrix that would be suitable for every business combination in every single scenario. And therefore, we are trying to explore a management approach whereby the matrix disclosed will be based on how the management of the company monitors the achievement of the objectives internally. And such matrices could be financial in nature, or they could be operational in nature, or they can just be a mixture of both. Next, turning on to some of the more detailed issue on providing such information. One of the first questions that were being asked is for how long should entities actually report on the subsequent performance of past acquisitions? And stakeholders have expressed different views on this, but there is a general consensus that this should be for a relatively short period of time. And the board is therefore suggesting that the disclosure be made for the year of acquisition as well as for two subsequent financial periods. And of course, if the facts and circumstances of the particular transaction would so warrant, that period could be longer. The second issue here relates to for what kind of acquisition will actually require such additional disclosure. Some stakeholders suggest that this would be needed for all material acquisitions, while others are concerned that doing so might be too onerous, especially for those companies that are accustomed to growing via acquisition mainly, or those companies that we usually refer to as serial acquirers. So the current proposal is to require the information to be made for all acquisitions, they are monitored by the chief operating decision maker of the company as defined by IFRS 8. And the rationale behind this is that if an acquisition is of a sufficient importance, then we will expect the CODM to actually monitor the transaction. And the converse would be true as well, whereby if the CODM is monitoring a particular transaction, then that transaction is likely to have at least met a certain level of importance threshold and will therefore be of interest to users. Finally, we have also heard from stakeholders that this proposal could face some potential barriers in practice. For example, business strategies could be commercially sensitive, and the integration of acquired businesses could also mean that the result of the acquired business cannot be isolated easily from that of the acquirer. We have discussed some of these barriers with the board's users and preparer consultative groups. And the initial indication was that the information could still be useful even if it is provided for the on a combined basis, and that this information need not be extremely detailed. And hopefully that could elevate some of those concerns relating to commercial sensitivity as well as integration. We have also heard that some preparers were worried that the disclosure of targets could be considered as forward-looking information, and that could pose a risk of litigation. We will definitely be very interested to hear from stakeholders like yourselves as to the extent to which that will be an issue given the legal and regulatory framework in different jurisdictions. So in the upcoming discussion paper, we will be also proposing some targeted changes and improvements to existing disclosure requirements. And the first piece of information relates to the disclosure of expected synergies. We've heard from users that they would like to have quantitative information about expected synergies in a business combination in order for them to understand the rationale for the acquisition price that they have paid. On the second piece of targeted improvement, we have heard from users that they would like to know the amount of debt as well as defined obligation, pension obligation assumed in a BISCOM, because they view that to be part of their capital outlay, and they would need such information in order to be able to assess the return on investor capital. So while the standard currently has a requirement to disclose the major classes of assets acquired and liabilities assumed, it does not really specify what particular kind of assets or liability that should be. So therefore, the view of the board is to specifically require those kind of liabilities to be disclosed in the financial statements. The third piece of information here relates to the actual and pro forma performance of the acquiree. The existing requirement is for an entity to provide, in the year of acquisition, the acquiree's revenue and profit or loss since the acquisition date, as well as the combined revenue and profit or loss of the combined entity as if the acquisition has occurred since the beginning of the period. And that later part of the information is what we usually refer to as pro forma information. The feedback that we had was that the standard has not been clear, especially in relation to the pro forma information, as to how it can be prepared. So while there has been some views that this information is of limited use and therefore should be taken away, many users actually tell us that this piece of information is actually quite crucial for their analysis, and therefore the board has decided to retain it. The board also would like to propose to define that particular measure of profit or loss as operating profit, which will be defined by the PFS project, and also to add another disclosure requirement on cash flow for the actual performance. We would also like to seek your views on in the discussion paper as to how this pro forma information should be prepared. So hopefully that gives you a very brief overview of the board's proposals on enhanced disclosure for business combination. And we will now move on to this eternal debate between amortization and impairment of goodwill. I will just firstly very briefly touch on the reason why the board is considering whether to reintroduce amortization of goodwill in this project. So as explained earlier, stakeholders commented that they think the impairment of goodwill is not recognized on a timely basis. And the board think that this could be due to two reasons. The first reason could be that because the cash flow estimates used by management is just being unjustifiably optimistic. And we think that that would be an issue with the application of the standard and should therefore be best addressed via other means rather than changing the standard itself. The second issue could be due to this shielding of goodwill from impairment by headroom. And the headroom here refers to the difference between the carrying amount and the recoverable amount of the CGU to which goodwill is a part of. And because of the existence of this headroom, whenever an entity is being hit with a loss event, any potential loss will first be offset against this headroom before impairment loss can be recognized against the goodwill. So in relation to this second issue on shielding, we have performed extensive research to investigate whether it is possible to target goodwill directly in an impairment test by looking at the model of the test that will actually incorporate headroom into the test itself. However, the board concluded that it is not really feasible to make significant improvements to the test. And because of this, many stakeholders think that amortization of goodwill could be a good solution to the problem. And I will touch on some of the reasons both supporting and against amortization in the following slides. But it is perhaps just worth mentioning at this point that any discussion that the board had in relation to amortization refers to an amortization model with impairment test and not an amortization-only approach. So the slides here summarizes some of the main arguments for and against reintroducing amortization. So in terms of the arguments for reintroducing amortization, back when the impairment-only approach was introduced by IFRS 3, a rigorous and operational impairment test was deemed as one of the important factors for the board to make that move. And given the feedback from the PRR that many stakeholders think the existing test was not really effective, some question whether the test is really operational and rigorous as intended. And if it is not, then given the board's previous position, whether amortization should be reintroduced. The frequent failure of corporate acquisitions may also indicate that an entity's goodwill balances may be, in many circumstances, in fact, overstated. And as it has not been feasible to devise a more effective impairment test, amortization might be viewed as a cost-effective mechanism to reduce the carrying amount of goodwill, and that could perhaps address the concern with potential overstatement of goodwill balances. Some stakeholders also think that this will help to better hold management to account by having a periodic amortization charge on the income statement. There are also, of course, arguments that goodwill itself is a wasting asset, and therefore a lot of these impairments that was being recognized by entities are in fact representing the consumption of this asset, and therefore it's not a true impairment and it should not be labeled as such. On the other hand, in terms of the arguments for retaining the impairment-only approach, although the information from this approach is often cited as only confirmatory, many stakeholders still think that it provides better information than amortization. And also, the impairment test is arguably not designed to test goodwill separately to begin with, but rather to test if goodwill, along with all the other assets and liabilities in the CGU, is able to jointly generate cash flow that can support the carrying amount of the CGU as a whole. And if you do take this view that the unit of account for the impairment test is the entire CGU rather than the individual goodwill balances, then one could suggest that there is perhaps not much evidence to say that the recognition of impairment loss is too late. There is also, of course, this argument that it's very difficult to determine how goodwill diminish over time. And if we do arbitrarily set a useful life for goodwill, then the resulting amortization expense will not be very helpful and could not really hold management to account. And therefore, part of the objectives of these proposals in the discussion paper is to provide users with the information that they need through disclosures rather than through the subsequent accounting of goodwill. Finally, it is also debatable as to how much amortization could help users to save cost, because even with an amortization model, there will still be impairment test. So in summary, We think that both models have their own issues, but there has not been overall compelling evidence to suggest that the reintroduction of amortization could bring about such a significant enough improvement to financial reporting that it would actually warrant such a radical change in practice. And therefore, given where things do stand at the moment, the board's view is that it should retain the impairment-only approach. However, the majority for this decision back at the board table in June, I believe, was rather small with an 8-6 majority, and we will therefore present a balanced view of both alternatives in the discussion paper and seek stakeholders' feedback as to whether there is any new evidence to help the board find a more conclusive answer to this problem. We are also very interested to explore further this too late issue and the basis for stakeholders' concern, whether you think that it's too late mainly because of an application issue, or it is mainly because of a difference in understanding as to the unit of account for impairment test, whether this impairment test should be targeted at goodwill directly, or it should be for the CGO as a whole. We would also like to ask stakeholders if the impairment-only model, along with all those enhanced disclosure requirements that we have mentioned just now, in your view, would be able to hold the management to account sufficiently. The next topic that we will touch on relates to providing entities with relief from mandatory quantitative annual test. So currently, under IAS 36, an entity needs to perform an annual impairment test of goodwill, regardless of whether there is any indicator of possible impairment. And this is because back when the board introduced the impairment-only approach, it believed that not amortizing goodwill will actually place greater reliance on the impairment test. And by increasing the frequency of the test, it could actually at least partly help to address this robustness issue. However, what we have heard from the feedback is that this test has been costly and complex to implement, and many stakeholders highlighted that having to perform the test even when there is no indicator of impairment could be one of the reasons that is contributing to this cost. And as discussed earlier, because the information provided by this test is limited, many stakeholders do question whether the cost of performing such tests are justified by the marginal benefits that they bring. Therefore, the board's view is to provide entities with relief from the annual quantitative test for goodwill, as well as for certain classes of intangible assets, and to require these tests only when there is indicators of possible impairment. And hopefully that could help preparers reduce some cost. And the main concern with this proposal, as you could imagine, is with its potential impact on the robustness of the test. And given the feedback that we have received relating to the effectiveness of the existing impairment test, some really find it counterintuitive to relax the test even further. However, if the main reason for the ineffectiveness of the impairment test is because of shielding, as highlighted earlier, then performing the test more frequently would not really help to resolve the issue, because the headroom that is shielding the goodwill from impairment will still be there regardless of how frequently you do this impairment test. We acknowledge that an indicator-only approach would perhaps have make the test less robust and introduce more judgment into the process, but we expect that reduction to be marginal, mainly because we would think that there would be at least some kind of indicator of impairment when an entity do experience a material impairment loss event. This is, of course, another area whereby board members have differing views, and there is only a 8-6 majority supporting this view. However, if the board had decided to reintroduce amortization instead, we would think that that could have an impact on the vote. We would certainly like to hear feedback from stakeholders on this proposal as well, particularly in relation to the extent of cost saving that it can have, as well as its potential impact on the robustness of the test. So with that, I would like to pass the time back to Chen Chao to take us through the rest of the presentation.
Okay, there are remaining, two topics. Why is that value in use? Because some people criticize that, okay, value in use is costly and complex, whether we can make some amendment to simplify the calculation of value in use. The existing requirements require to estimate value in use based on the future cash flow forecast. But the cash flows from future restructuring and enhancement were not allowed to be included. And the reason why the board made a decision when the board issued the standards many years ago, I think very simple, because they think that the assets and entity test should be based on the current condition, not based on the future condition, because once the assets enhance, the condition changes. But in practice, as many preparers told us, that this requirement causes a lot of additional cost and complexity. The reason why? Because this requirement is not consistent with management budget and forecast. That means management budget or forecast always including this kind of cash flows arising from future restructurings and enhancement. Therefore, the board decided to include those cash flows from future restructurings and enhancement in estimating value in use. However, of course, it will simplify the existing practice, reduce the cost, no problem. But when the board deliberates these views and also seek feedback from stakeholders, some stakeholders told us that they have another concern, because the risk of unjustifiable optimistic input included in the calculation of value in use will increase, because those really cash flow really depends on future, especially some future uncommitted restrictions and enhancement. Therefore, the staff originally developed a proposal to set certain threshold for those cash flows could be included in the value in use. They needed to subject to certain threshold, which we originally staff proposed that more likely than not. If those cash flow more likely than not can flow into the entity, they could be included. Otherwise, not. But finally, the board decided to reject that suggestion. So keep simplification as the board initially proposed. But the board also mentioned that even we remove that, do not want to introduce any threshold, but those cash flows should be subjected to the existing IAS 36 requirement. Actually, there's two requirements could add a discipline on those cash flows forecasts. First, those cash flows should be based on reasonable and supportable assumption, which is in IAS 36. Second, all those management budget and forecast should be approved by the management. But if there is a good governance there, maybe can get additional discipline on those future cash flow forecasts. So this is the first one, first simplification with regard to the value in use calculation. Second one, actually very simple, because if you needed to calculate the value in use, you have to get to know what's the discount rate you actually need to use. But existing standards only allow entity to use pre-tax basis future cash flows as well as pre-tax discount rate. And in practice, preparers told us that actually, normally preparers performance calculation of value in use based on post-tax basis. And pre-tax discount rate normally are not available, not directly observable. So therefore, the board decided to allow post-tax input and a discount rate to be used in calculation of value in use. Of course, it will simplify existing, you know, practice, and but unless all those cash flow calculations and discount rate should be consistent with each other. That means if the cash flow you use is pre-tax, the discount rate should use should be used for you used as is pre-tax tax rate. Otherwise, if post-tax discount rate used, cash flow should also be based on the post-tax basis. And also, of course, we also require the entity to disclose those post-tax discount rates. We believe that those disclosure requirements will provide useful information to users. So the last topic will be covered in the discussion paper is intangible assets. As I said before, the existing standard require entity to identify those some of the intangible assets, such as business, as I said, customer relationships, brands, you know, and to measure them at fair value and to be recognized on the balance sheets separately from goodwill. However, some preparers told us that it's very cost, and the measuring those assets at fair value, sometimes they question about the reliability of the fair value. Because as I said, that normally those intangible assets, there are no active markets available. But however, some users or some stakeholders also told us that maybe separately identifying those assets and measuring those assets at fair value can reduce the burden of impairment test of goodwill. Secondly, it can convince users or management that what kind of assets you really acquired. Of course, some users also don't believe that because they think the nature of those intangible assets similar to the goodwill. So that means it's better to include those intangible assets in the goodwill, to not necessarily separate those intangible assets from goodwill. The board did discuss this issue, and finally we decided that there is no comparing evidence show that if we allow those intangible assets to be included in the goodwill, could significantly reduce the cost. So therefore, we propose that not change it to existing requirement. So what's the next step? Now the staff and the board are in the process of drafting the discussion paper, and we expect to issue this discussion paper earlier next year, maybe most likely February 2020, and the comment period will be 180 days. So we are looking forward to your comments, and particularly those new evidence, new findings, new approaches, would be highly appreciated, because this issue has been discussed and deliberated many, many, many years. We have been collected a lot of information and evidence, but those new evidence, new approaches, new methodologies, will really help appreciate if you can deliver and submit to us. So now let's move to the Slido questions. Okay, good, yeah. So question one, do you think an entity should disclose subsequent performance information for all material business combinations? Whether management monitor them or not? More answers. Yeah, it's clearly that I think most of us agree that it will provide we needed to disclose, needed to require entity to disclose those subsequent performance information. Maybe can reach to, yes, okay, it's fine, I think it's fine, yeah. Okay, close, yeah. So now the message is very clear. Seems the board made a wise decision, yeah. And the second question is that if an entity disclose its business combination based on what management monitored, do you think that management should be defined as chief operating decision maker? A, yes. B, no. Okay. Yeah, should we close? Yeah, I think the message is also clear, but most of us agree with we should identify those management as CODM, but I think one third of us also think that maybe, I'm not sure whether do not necessarily to define it, just simply, principle-based, let the management decide, okay? And the third question, Third question is, what do you think is the main reason for stakeholders' concern of the timeliness of goodwill impairment? That is the too late issue. What's the reason? The reason, I think there are two reasons. One is our accounting treatment, because there's shielding effect existing accounting treatment. Another is actually management behavior. Yeah. So it seems that most of us, that both sides has some, contribution to the too late issues. Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the next question. Because, as I said several times, impairment tests cannot directly target goodwill. Goodwill cannot separately contribute to the future cash flows. So what is this, explaining why this is the case, reduce stakeholders' concern, A or B? Okay, seems most, yeah. Okay, oh, yeah, A is increasing. Okay, shall we, yeah, close, yeah. I think, yeah, many of us agree, but it seems that some of us not convinced that whether this is the main factor contribute to the concerns stakeholder raised. So now next question, I think this is the most exciting question. Yeah, which approach we should work on and can better address the issues now we have. A, existing impairment test only model, we should retain it, or we should reintroduce amortization of goodwill. Come on. Yeah. Okay. More answers, yeah. Okay, shall we? Okay, just stop here, I think. It seems that the message now I received a little bit different from the board's decision. Yeah, because both, when we vote, that is 8-6. Now it seems to turn around. Yeah, okay. Which one? Yeah. So this? Yeah. Yes, intangible assets. So how should intangible assets such as customer relationships and the brand acquired in a business should be recognized. Do you agree with, you know, existing requirements, substantial recognition, or should be included in goodwill, or this issue should be considered in a larger project that is a larger intangible assets project? Yeah, I also see very interesting answers. If you prefer C, that means I think 50% of us agree with this issue should be considered in the larger project. So that's good, because I nearly mentioned that we are going to do a gender consultation. Let's wait a moment. You can submit your views, open up another big project that is intangible assets to address this issue, okay? Okay, should we stop here? Yeah. And last question, because our documents are going to come out, that's the discussion paper. So what kind of materials, activities would be helpful in your jurisdictions to help stimulate feedback to the discussion paper? There are several options. I think your answer will guide us to do what kind of outreach, what kind of activities we need to undertake about the next step once discussion paper is issued. Okay. Okay, should we stop here? Yeah. I think first, it seems that most of us would like to face-to-face meetings, not only those regional events, but also webcasts. You can see who are talking, whether what we are talking is right or not. But face-to-face and this kind of discussion may be very helpful. So I think next step, maybe after the discussion paper issued, we need to reach out more to engage all of you. Okay, thank you. So now, okay. So now I got the question. Yeah. Can you see that question? Yes, now there are several questions because time is limited. So we are going to pick up several. One question asked is whether the goodwill meets the definition of assets. I think definitely it meets the definition of assets, because based on our revised conception framework, an asset is the resources an entity controlled as a result of past event. And those resources should be the current right, and that current light can generate future economic benefit. I think when an entity acquire a business, pay the price, they are expected a future, as Deha said, future scenarios. So that means they can receive the future economic benefit through that goodwill at the acquisition date. So I think at the acquisition date, the goodwill recognized meets the definition of the assets from my point of view. So this is the first question. Second question about the proposed subsequent performance disclosure appear to only apply to newly acquired goodwill. How about those goodwill long acquired in the books? I think, Deha, okay. Do you want to answer this question? Yeah.
Okay. I think there's perhaps 2 points on this. Hello? Yeah, I think there's perhaps 2 points on this. The first is that
As I've mentioned just now, because part of this proposal is that for the enhanced disclosure, we are only looking at the time-limited disclosure, so we are not really requiring companies to disclose for all past acquisitions since the incorporation of the entity. And that is as the board's decision stands now. The tentative decision was to require those disclosure for at least two financial periods. So it's not for all past acquisitions. And of course, this will also be one of the issues, depending on the feedback that we have received from the discussion paper. It will be a further issue that needs to be considered in terms of this transition requirement as well.
And I think there are several questions mentioned that I think mentioned about the behavior of the recognition of goodwill. Some companies during the process of the IPO, goodwill always, you know, overstated, some question mentioned, some entities misuse of the goodwill before listing. But I think one of us already answered the question, said that IPO goodwill is an ethical issue, not an accounting issue. I agree. I think this is relevant to the goodwill. Are relevant to the behavior, governance, auditing, and the regulator. As this is too broad issue, I think. And any projects for revising the existing alternative to goodwill recognition, full or partial? As I said, that maybe this issue should be addressed a broader project, not this project. I think, yeah. With any questions? Another question said that about the value in use. Actually, it's not exactly the question. And it said that there is business life cycles as well as product life cycles. So as long as there is no value in use of the goodwill, impairment to be charged in larger amounts. I agree, but it should not be charged later. I think when the management forecasts the future cash flow, should consider those business life cycle. Do not necessarily to wait until, you know, large amount of impairment loss recognized. I think it's too late. So this is not, as I said, you should, all the future cash flow estimation forecast should be based on reasonable and supportable assumptions, including those business life circles. I think all the questions, yeah, answered.
I think there have been a number of interesting questions in this session, and I thought it was also interesting because I thought that one about pre-IPO goodwill could, to some extent, cross over with the business combinations under common control. You know, some of the issues that the staff looked at in terms of scoping that. And so if you're thinking about those issues, think about looking at the BCUCC project, as it is fondly known, to see if there's to see how we've drawn the scope of that project and how that will, or in many cases will not, address, you know, pre-IPO transactions. I also thought that the broader project on goodwill idea was an interesting crossover with some of the things we'll be looking at in our agenda consultation, and I'm sure Neely is about to look up and sit up very straight about that, because that really does get into significant change in the scope from the project that you guys have been talking about today. But as we wrap up the session, I will ask you to join me in saying thanks after I observe that I'm not sure that Qingjiao is an absolutely impartial facilitator on the question of goodwill amortization or not, and that you can all see from Den Hao's presentation how he makes us all very calm about this very difficult project, because he's very good at making everything seem very straightforward in terms of the analysis and understanding of the issues. So please join me first in thanking them both for giving us this overview.
Thank you. Okay.